against the war in Russia. And tomorrow our friends in Berlin, in Germany, will call for the escalation of conflict between Russia, Ukraine, United States and NATO countries. Our friends in Berlin are making human chain between the embassies of United States and Russia. It is the best symbolic way to show how bonds of humanity between people should prevail over fear, hatred and hysterical warmongering.
Yuri, we want to thank you so much for being with us, and we will be revisiting you soon. Yuri Shelyachenko is the executive secretary of the Ukrainian Pacifist Movement, board member of the European Bureau for Conscientious Objection, and World Beyond War. By the way, all of our transcripts are online of every show, of every segment at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe.
This is Norman Sylvester, the Boogie Cat. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, community radio.
Did you know that KBOO is streaming live on the web? Well, you do now. Just type www.kboo.fm, click on Listen Live, and you've got us. Just another example of how KBOO 90.7 FM Portland works for you. It's your community radio.
Slip a bookmark into your paperback and listen to KBOO for interviews with your favorite fiction and nonfiction writers. Between the Covers airs Thursdays from 11 to 11:30 a.m. here on KBOO 90.7 FM.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
On the KBOO Evening News, a proposal in the state legislature would give $600 to low-income Oregonians. Tuesday marked the 2022 low for COVID cases in the state. And in national news, the January 6th committee will have access to Capitol visitor records from the day of the insurrection. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, February 16th, 2022. I'm Josh Salem. House Democrats reintroduced a bill in the Oregon legislature on Tuesday that would send one-time $600 payments to over a quarter million Oregonians. The bill focuses on around 260,000 low and middle income people who file for earned income tax credits. It's a revision of a proposal Democrats have considered in the past. The new bill would simply send payments to those who qualify, where the previous idea would have created a process for workers to apply for the checks. The previous bill also limited payments to certain occupations, while the new payments would expand on who's eligible. These payments would not be taxable or eligible for garnishment. Representative Andrea Valderrama of East Portland is one of the chief sponsors of the bill. The representative said of the bill, quote, "We know that working and low-wage families need this funding now," end quote. She continued, quote, "Workers need to be able to afford the rising cost of groceries, prescriptions, childcare, and all of those things," end quote. According to Oregon Department of Revenue data, there are three counties with the most residents to reap the potential benefits: Malheur, Klamath, and Jefferson counties. The Oregon Supreme Court is expected to deliver its ruling on whether Nicholas Kristof will be allowed to run for governor early Thursday morning. Kristof is a former New York Times columnist who already raised nearly $3 million since announcing his candidacy in the fall. His campaign hit a snag, though, when Oregon Secretary of State Shemaiah Fagan denied his official declaration of candidacy. Kristof grew up in Oregon and his own property in Yamhill County for many years. But Oregon law says in order to run for office, you have to live in the state for the past 3 years. And until 2020, Kristof lived in New York. He voted in New York elections, held a New York driver's license, and paid taxes there. He appealed the decision from the Secretary of State, and now the state Supreme Court will weigh in. Some think the court will be reluctant to deny Kristof when it has the potential to have a big impact on the governor's race. Also in the Democratic primary are former Oregon House Speaker Tina Kotek and former State Treasurer Tobias Reed. The ruling will be announced tomorrow, Thursday, at 8:30 a.m. Oregon had a 2022 record low number of COVID cases on Tuesday. The Oregon Health Authority reported 1,613 infections, a number almost seven times lower than at the peak. The hospitalization rate is also dropping, though institutions remain stretched. 805 inpatients were reported, a drop of 60 from the day before. Statewide, 8% of intensive care unit beds are unoccupied, and 6% of non-intensive care unit beds are available. Vaccination rates are falling as well. The seven-day average as of Valentine's Day was 5,104, down from around 18,000 the week of January 11th. These downward trends were predicted by experts and were the major reason underlying the planned lifting of Oregon's mask mandate on March 31st. Omicron infections actually hit their peak last month. Enrollment at Portland Public Schools is down, and staffing levels will be impacted, according to a letter sent out to workers Wednesday. Over the last 2 years, they've dropped 7,000 students, mostly at the elementary school level. Officials at the district say that factors like declining birth rates, enrollment patterns, school changes, and choices made by parents in a pandemic are all contributors. It will likely result in 65 elementary teachers getting laid off, though one-time federal funding has kept some of those jobs secure. Multnomah County school districts lost enrollment at a much higher margin than school districts in the rest of the state. Biden warns Putin to de-escalate. The January 6th committee digs deeper into claims of false electors, and Sandy Hook parents win a key lawsuit against an arms manufacturer. With those stories and more, it's Mary Schuerman with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
If Russia decides to invade, that would also have consequences here at home. But the American people understand that defending democracy and liberty is never without cost.
President Joe Biden said diplomacy with Russia should be given a chance, but he noted that the U.S. won't compromise on Ukraine's territorial integrity. Russia announced it's pulling back some of its troops from military exercises, but some observers noted that the retreating units already were far from the Ukraine border. The House January 6th committee subpoenaed two members of the Trump campaign and four prominent Republican officials from battleground states. The panel is seeking details about alleged efforts to send false electors to change the outcome of the 2020 presidential election. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer wants to force an initial vote on taking up the short-term funding bill as soon as Thursday. In exchange, Republicans are pushing for amendment votes on vaccine mandates and a balanced budget. The Department of Health and Human Services is requesting at least $30 billion for continued COVID-19 response efforts, but some lawmakers question additional funding, arguing that the multiple rounds already released have contributed to rising inflation. Here's South Dakota Republican Senator John Thune.
The definition of inflation is too many dollars chasing too few goods and services. And that's exactly the situation Democrats helped create with their so-called American Rescue Plan. They sent too many dollars into the economy, and the economy overheated.
Republicans prevented votes on five of Biden's Federal Reserve nominees with the goal of specifically blocking the nomination of Sarah Bloom Raskin. They questioned her past statements expressing support for using financial rules to police climate change. Senate Banking Committee Chair Sherrod Brown blasted all of the 12 Republicans who boycotted the vote.
Let me be clear, Ms. Bloom Raskin has been the subject of an unrelenting smear campaign in fear-mongering by the ranking member and Republicans.
Despite concerns about his ties to the pharmaceutical industry, the Senate confirmed Robert Califf as the next FDA commissioner, with six Republicans in favor and five Democrats against. Remington Arms agreed to settle liability claims from nine families of Sandy Hook shooting victims who argued the firearm used was marketed to younger, at-risk males. Nicole Hockley lost her son Dylan and says the lawsuit is part of her pledge to prevent future gun violence.
Nothing will bring Dylan back. The closest I get to him now is by kissing his urn every night, telling him I love him and I miss him. But I made him a promise, and I'll keep working to deliver that promise for the rest of my life.
This is the first time a gun manufacturer has been held responsible for a mass shooting. Police have identified a Louisville activist as a suspect in an attempted shooting of mayoral candidate Craig Greenberg. 21-year-old Quintez Brown pleaded not guilty Tuesday to attempted murder. Investigators reportedly are looking into his ties with racial justice groups. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
A bill in Congress seeks to help tackle violence in Alaska Native villages. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. To help tackle the violence in Alaska Native villages, a bill in Congress would expand tribal court jurisdiction. In a pilot program, up to 30 Alaska tribes would be able to hold criminal trials and sentence anyone who commits domestic or sexual violence in their villages, even if the offender is non-Native. Alaska Public Media Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin reports.
Michelle Demert, Law and Policy Director at the Alaska Native Women's Resource Center, says perpetrators who prey on women and children are really smart. They know where they can get away with crimes.
They've taken advantage of villages for, you know, forever. I mean, this is an issue from first contact where they've known that they can do things with impunity. And, you know, this is our chance to say no more.
Senator Lisa Murkowski added the Alaska pilot program to a bill that would renew the Violence Against Women Act. The last time VAWA was renewed in 2013, it allowed lower 48 tribes the power to prosecute all cases of domestic violence on their reservations, regardless of the defendant's race or tribal membership. Murkowski remembers how controversial it was.
There was a great deal of concern that this was going to change administration of justice. It was going to be, there were not going to be courts that were serious. It was a matter that was very hotly contested and debated.
Now more than 24 tribes exercise those powers with grants and technical assistance from the Justice Department. Murkowski says it works, and the predictions of terrible injustice have not come to pass. She says the change the bill makes for Alaska is limited.
We're not creating Indian country through this. It is just a recognition that in order to provide for a level of safety in our communities, we had to look to some alternatives.
But tribal jurisdiction is a little trickier in Alaska. Of Alaska's 229 tribes, only one, Metlakatla, has a reservation. Many of the others have tribal courts that decide child protection and adoption cases, bootlegging, and interpersonal violence. Their power over non-members is limited. The House and Senate versions of the VAWA reauthorization bill would change that for participating tribes. The Senate bill relies on census tract information to define the jurisdiction boundaries, and it leaves it up to the U.S. Justice Department to decide whether a tribe is eligible. Alaska Governor Mike Dunleavy did not take a position on the expansion of tribal criminal jurisdiction when asked about it last week. He said he's still reviewing the bills, but will ensure, quote, everybody's constitutional rights are protected, unquote. I'm Liz Ruskin.
Another grim discovery of graves at former residential schools in Canada. The Kiskus First Nation in Saskatchewan found more than 50 grave sites using ground-penetrating radar at two schools in and near the First Nation. The community hosted a more than two-hour press conference Tuesday. Chief Lee Ketchumonia.
We had unmarked graves in our community, in our common areas that we drive every day, that we walk every day. We passed by them, never realizing that there was graves there. And that's got to be the most hurtful part is the way they were hidden.
First Nations across Canada have conducted similar searches following the May 2021 discovery of more than 200 remains at a former residential school in British Columbia. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on a bill in the Oregon legislature that could limit police traffic stops for minor offenses. Karen James interviews Julianne Jackson from the Partnership for Safety and Justice to learn more. At 6, it's Rural Roots Rising, produced by and for rural Oregon communities. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be cloudy skies and a low of 43 degrees. Tomorrow, those clouds continue with a daytime high of 51. Today in history, in 1957, American actor, director, and children's TV host LeVar Burton was born. Burton is known for his roles in Roots and Star Trek The Next Generation, as well as being the host of the PBS show Reading Rainbow. The quote of the day is from Burton, who said, quote, "As long as we are engaged in storytelling that moves the culture forward, it doesn't matter what format it is." The January 6th Investigation Committee in Congress will get access to visitor logs to the Capitol the day of the insurrection, logs that Trump fought hard to keep from them. President Joe Biden has directed the National Archive to turn over White House visitor logs around the time of the January 6th attack on the Capitol to the House committee investigating that event. White House counsel Dana Remus wrote a letter describing the order to the National Archives on Monday. It stated that Biden did consider Trump's claim that because he was president at the time of the attack, the record should remain private, but determined that it was, quote, not in the best interest of the United States, end quote, to do so. Later, Remus said that, quote, Congress has a compelling need to see the documents and that, quote, constitutional protections of executive privilege should not be used to shield from Congress or the public information that reflects a clear and apparent effort to subvert the Constitution itself, end quote. In recent weeks, the House Select Committee has become increasingly focused on Trump's Oval Office, as it also attempts to unravel his efforts to overturn his election defeat by Biden. Recent revelations have uncovered that a war room of Trump insiders, including Rudy Giuliani, was set up to devise ways to stop Biden from taking office. Two new reports study two opposite water problems, drought in the West and rising global sea levels. A study published Monday says the American West has spent the last two decades in the most extreme megadrought in 1,200 years. Researchers also noted that human-caused temperature rise is a significant driver of the destructive conditions and predicted even drier and hotter decades ahead. Nearly 65% of America, between the Rockies and the Pacific, are experiencing extreme drought. Last month, California saw one of the driest Januaries on record, while record-breaking heat waves in February caused snowmelt in the Sierras, dwindling the snowpack to below average. Meanwhile, ocean levels along the U.S. coastline are projected to rise by an average of 10 to 12 inches over the next three decades, according to a report released Tuesday by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and other federal agencies. That potential one-foot rise is equal to the amount of sea level rise that had happened over the last 100 years. The amount of rise will vary regionally due to changes in land and ocean height. A 14 to 18 inch rise is expected for the Gulf Coast, while the West Coast would only see a 4 to 8 inch rise. Christina Dahl is a climate scientist with the Union of Concerned Scientists. Dahl said in her research, 10 to 12 inches of sea level rise by 2050 would threaten approximately 140,000 homes with chronic inundation or flooding every week on average. A measure in Congress would guarantee $50 million to grants for protecting wildlife migration corridors on tribal lands. Tribes often have limited resources compared to state and federal governments. Eric Tegetoff has more on the story.
Migration routes for wildlife across the country are in peril. Tribes could get more support from Congress to protect these corridors. The Tribal Wildlife Corridors Act would send $50 million per year in grants for Native American efforts to improve wildlife habitat. Shaylin Miller with the Native American Fish and Wildlife Society, who grew up in Montana, says animals don't recognize political boundaries. She adds this legislation would ensure they can travel safely across a checkerboard of lands, while reinforcing tribal sovereignty to manage corridors.
Tribes are severely underfunded and at a huge disadvantage due to extremely limited resources, especially when compared to state or federal wildlife agencies.
Migration corridors are especially important for big game species like elk, mule deer, and pronghorn. More than 20 tribal nations and organizations have supported the legislation so far. There are 12 federally recognized tribes in Montana. Miller says tribes already are working to protect wildlife migration paths, including the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes in northwest Montana.
The Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes were one of the first tribes to be involved in wildlife corridor work starting in the early 2000s. This includes a project that installed wildlife fencing combined with dozens of wildlife underpasses and one wildlife overpass on tribal land.
In the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, $350 million has been set aside over 5 years for the Wildlife Crossings Pilot Program. Miller says tribes also can apply for this funding to help supplement their habitat protection work. For Big Sky Connection, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Hydrogen has potential as a clean fuel, depending on how it's produced. For more on the difference between green, gray, and blue hydrogen, it's Dr. Anthony Leisowitz with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Hydrogen fuel burns clean, so it has potential as a low-carbon energy source, depending on how it's made. Today, most hydrogen is known as gray hydrogen. It's derived from natural gas using an energy-intensive process that emits a lot of carbon dioxide. Blue hydrogen is sometimes touted as a clean alternative. It's essentially the same as gray hydrogen, but the CO2 emissions are captured during production, so they're kept out of the atmosphere. But Mark Jacobson, a professor of civil and environmental engineering at Stanford, warns that blue hydrogen is not really a climate-friendly option. That's partly because it still relies on natural gas, and producing and piping natural gas is a major source of climate-warming methane leaks. However, Jacobson says there is a better way to make hydrogen fuel.
The easiest way to produce hydrogen is just to pass electricity through water. And if you generate the electricity with clean renewable energy like wind or solar power, then the whole process of producing the hydrogen is clean, and that's called green hydrogen.
As solar and wind power get cheaper, so will the cost of green hydrogen. So he says it's a more promising path forward than gray or blue. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael isn't sure which team he's on.
The Super Bowl ads told us to be bold, ignore the real borders of our budgets, buy gas-guzzling trucks, gamble on sports and cryptocurrency. While the world's Olympic athletes find themselves in the most elaborate set of hamster tunnels, in China but not among any Chinese, fearful to speak up and be disqualified. While the truckers at the Canadian border protest vaccine mandates but not soaring fuel prices, their grueling working conditions, or substandard pay. As gerrymandering and ballot restrictions take effect for upcoming primaries, voting will be the new sport, like hurdles and rock climbing in a labyrinth. Next month, March Madness won't be about basketball. States already dropping COVID mandates. Spring will get in our blood, and we'll need to express ourselves in crowds of various sizes, celebrating the defeat of Omicron, certain there won't be another variant, while many line up for their next booster. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
The pandemic created severe disruptions for children and parents trying to keep up with schoolwork and educational milestones. It has also increased their screen time, be it social media or video games. The National Parent Teacher Association has new tools available for parents wanting to help their kids grow and stay safe online. Roz Brown reports.
The pandemic caused kids' screen time to soar. Some of it spent playing video games and using social media. Now, the National Parent Teachers Association has introduced a Smart Talk tool to address the issue. Carrie Neal, the NPTA's Connected Ambassador, says the tool is designed to help parents start a meaningful conversation with their kids and lay out ground rules for being online and using mobile devices.
The Smart Talk tool brings that power to families to collaboratively discuss what are we comfortable with, what are the parameters, and gives parents some language to work off of, and it gives kids a voice in the conversation.
Neal says PTA Connected is designed to educate and engage families on everything digital, from wellness to security to access, equity, and literacy. She adds parents can go to the website pta.org/saferinternet for guidance on how to facilitate a safe experience when kids use social media or gaming sites. Neal says parents should not wait to address the issue of screen time until their kids are missing in action from family activities or it's causing friction among family members.
So really, it's just being brave and having that conversation with your child, not avoiding it or waiting until there's a problem or a situation that might result in a consequence. So proactively reaching out and having that discussion is so, so important.
She adds the tool encourages parents to explain, for example, who should be considered a stranger online, and to make sure kids know not to give out personal information like their address, school, or birth date online. The National PTA site also has links to programs such as Create with Kindness, addressing responsible online behavior and how to enable parental controls on TikTok. For Texas News Service, I'm Roz Brown.
P.J. O'Rourke, prolific author and satirist, has died at age 74 from complications of lung cancer. O'Rourke was a student activist, contributing to 1960s counterculture, and he evolved into a very well-known conservative/libertarian. O'Rourke was quite prolific. He wrote around 20 books that appeared regularly in The Atlantic, The American Spectator, Rolling Stone, and The Weekly Standard. He was the conservative side of a point-counterpoint segment in 60 Minutes, opposite Molly Ivins. He was also an early writer for National Lampoon, helping promote the careers of John Belushi and Chevy Chase. He was a frequent guest on many different talk shows. Though identified as a Republican, O'Rourke satirized both political parties regularly. He stated, quote, "Democrats are the party that says government will make you smarter, taller, richer, and remove the crabgrass on your lawn. The Republicans are the party that says the government doesn't work and then gets elected and proves it," end quote. Another famous quote was, "God is a Republican and Santa Claus is a Democrat." Despite his political affiliation, O'Rourke stated he was going to vote for Hillary Clinton in the 2016 election. He called Donald Trump unstable and dangerous and said no one liked him. O'Rourke was said to be less prickly in person. Journalist Michael Kinsley once called him an anarchist with a heart of gold. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, February 16th, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Dan Raphael, Karen James, and Josh Salem. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegetoff, Antonia Gonzalez, Mary Sherman, Roz Brown, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2A2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Josh Salem. Coming up tomorrow on KBOO at 8, it's Sojourner Truth Radio, News and Views, hosted by Margaret Prescott. At 9, Fight the Empire, connecting history to the latest world events. At 10, it's American Standoff with Jacqueline Keeler. Then at 11, it's Between the Covers. Avi Mars interviews Elizabeth McCracken about her newest collection of short stories, The Souvenir Museum. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth. Karen James interviews Julianne Jackson from the Partnership for Safety and Justice about a bill in the Oregon legislature to limit traffic stops for certain minor offenses.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
The Transforming Justice Coalition is back in Salem with unfinished business from the 2021 Oregon legislative session. This year, Senate Bill 1510 proposes to reduce unnecessary police stops, improve success for people on probation and parole, and address racial disparities in the criminal legal system. With me is Julianne Jackson and Talia Gadd with Partnership for Safety and Justice. So let's first talk about how this bill will reduce unnecessary police stops.
So the first part of the bill aims to reduce racial disparities in traffic stops, really reform traffic, how traffic stops are done. One of the reforms is to make a single broken headlight, taillight, brake light, or license plate light a secondary offense. So what that means is that an officer can still issue a citation if a driver is pulled over for something else, but it would eliminate unnecessary stops if that's the only issue. A second way that it would reform how traffic stops are done is that law enforcement would be required to notify drivers of their right to refuse their consent to a search. So similar to Miranda rights, where people have the right to know what their rights are, when this would do something very similar, letting drivers know that they actually do have the right to refuse to consent to a search. And I'll just add that for both of these, if there is a significant public safety concern, and for example, there's some very concrete and evident reason why a search still does need to be conducted, there is still a higher bar of public safety where that search can still be conducted under that law that's not actually affected by this bill.
And they do not have to notify the driver or ask for their consent to search in those instances where there is probable cause or reasonable suspicion to search a vehicle. Is that correct?
Correct.
So why do we need such a law?
I think that's really best explained by Babette. He's joining Partnership for Safety and Justice, and I think I'll just let him explain that.
My name is Babak Zulfagari-Azhar, and I use he, him, his pronouns. And I am a man of Middle Eastern descent with short black hair, full beard, and brown eyes. And I'm part of the Transforming Justice Coalition. Oregonians deserve to feel safe and be treated with dignity. Many of us, especially Black, Indigenous, Latinx, and other people of color, feel vulnerable and unprotected in our own communities, in part because unnecessary interactions with law enforcement increase risks of excessive force and violence. I can recall every detail over the last few years of the 15 police stops I've experienced in my life and the countless court appearances as a result of those stops. As a 17-year-old minor, the summer after I graduated from high school as an almost straight-A student, I was taken to Washington County adult jail for furnishing alcohol to minors just to be taught a lesson in scared straight.